Welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast, where you'll learn how to structure terms and use various creative financing strategies to create profitable deals for short and long-term wealth. Whether you're a buy and hold investor, wholesaler, or flipper, learning creative financing will help you do more deals and unlock profits that you may not even know existed. On the Creative Financing Podcast, we break down actual deals we and our guests are doing and simplify the methods and terms used to execute these strategies. Now, let's dive in and create some terms.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Gallegos, here with
Jeff Rappaport.
And welcome, guys. This is episode number 30 for us. That's kind of a milestone, right, Jeff?
Absolutely.
We're pretty proud of that. So
when we started, I don't know if either of us thought we would get to 30 episodes.
Yeah, and there's a lot of work that's put into this, both, you know, putting the content together, and, you know, doing the back end stuff, editing and getting it up. So it does take a lot of work.
You are the superstar with that, by the way.
Thank you. And I couldn't do this without you either, Jeff, because, you know, I don't know the subject matter as well as you do. And you're a great teacher. And just the way you explain things has been phenomenal for me anyway.
A match made in heaven.
So episode number 30, we have over 5,000 downloads right now. I think we're averaging right around 100 downloads a day, and it's just growing. So we're starting to get feedback, so we're loving this. And guys, please keep the momentum going. For all of our fans out there, we appreciate you guys. So pass this on. Today, what are we talking about, Jeff?
So we're going to continue on with talking about some mistakes or things that investors tend to forget when dealing with creative financing. And this will be specifically with the buyer side. We had just covered on the seller side.
Gotcha. So this would be like the 15 mistakes investors make with buyers when using creative financing.
Yeah, let's hope that it's not mistakes, but things that sometimes get overlooked.
Perfect. Okay. Well, let's dive in. Number one.
All right. So this one's my favorite. It applies whether it's owner financing or lease options, and it seems very elementary. However, it is not. It is not getting enough down payment from your buyer. So this is kind of the crucial part. If you don't get enough, chances are there's a reason why, and the risk that comes along with getting a smaller down payment is probably going to come to fruition. So the more money you get, the less risk that you have.
On your part.
On your part or on the seller's part, however you may be handling this. And let's be clear, too, that I'm going to be speaking on two different perspectives for the most part. One is wholesaling these kinds of deals, so where we're just dealing with the seller and then we're wholesaling it to a buyer, or we're staying in the middle somehow, either buying it and then doing something or becoming the bank.
Yeah.
So the down payment, I'll tell you a couple of quick stories just because I just got an email yesterday. So out of all the owner financing deals that we've put together over the last 4.5 years or so, not one of them has gone bad.
Okay.
We did this one small little house in Nampa, Idaho. It's probably 1,000 square feet. It's on the very low end. It's probably the lowest priced house we've actually done owner financing on.
Okay.
And if I remember correctly, the price on the house we contracted, I think it was like $109,000, and was $7,000 down.
Okay.
And yeah, the payment's ridiculous, like $500 a month or something.
Okay? Uh-huh.
And we found a buyer that was going to bring $40,000 down.
Oh, wow.
So I went back to the seller and I said, okay, we found a buyer. However, his credit is not good. And we're going to talk about credit throughout, but sometimes you see people's credit and they are chronic problems, right?
Right.
It's not like some life event happens.
Yeah, it's a one-time deal.
It's constant.
Yeah.
Okay, and his credit score, if I remember right, was like in the low to mid 500s.
Okay.
So pretty bad. And I told the seller, there is a risk here. And he said, I don't care. I've been trying to sell this house for a while. I'm basically getting all of my equity out. I'll deal with the risk. And I said, all right, let's be clear, because big down payment's great, but in this case, I wasn't so sure that it could happen. And really what happened is this buyer had inherited some money.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a tremendous amount of money and was going to use a large portion of it as this down payment. However, then there wasn't a lot of money left to continue to, you know,
make payments.
Yes. So the seller's contacted me a couple of times over the last year and a half or so, saying, hey, yeah, he's late every month. I think we might have to do something. Well, yesterday he emailed me and said, I think it's time. And the guy has moved out. He's renting it to a friend. I mean, we're talking about like a $500 a month payment. Between them all, they can't afford it somehow. So,
yeah.
This is the case where, hey, you did get the big down payment. I mean, what's the worst thing that could happen? I mean, I'll probably get back involved in this deal. And I'm gonna go to the seller and I'm going to say, look, you have a couple of choices. One is I can just help you, consult with you as far as what you need to do to get them out, and you'll pay all the expense. Or if you don't want to be done, I'll be happy to take over this person's position. I'll pay to get him out of there, do whatever, and I'll get your house cashed out so you can just be done with this. Why wouldn't I? The guy put down $40,000, you know, 2 years ago, and you know, the house is only appreciated, probably not a lot, but it's probably worth $125,000. And my guess is that there's like a $70,000 balance or so left on it. If he wants me to do that, I'm fine doing that.
Okay, so is this a contract for deed deal that you
did? Yes, it was a contract for deed deal.
So all you guys would have to do is the forfeiture.
Yes.
And take it to court, do the forfeiture.
And I'll have to do a little research because I don't know if Idaho, this was in Idaho, it has a forfeiture process.
Okay.
So worst case scenario is we've got to foreclose.
Okay.
And either way, to be honest, I think what I would do is go back to the buyer and say, you're going to lose the house one way or the other. If you just move and sign over a deed, extinguish your ownership, here, I'll give you $2,500,
yeah,
which is probably going to be what I would spend plus, you know, having plus to make loan time payments.
Yeah, that time frame.
Yeah. But this is why you want a good size down payment. It protects you. One is, the more money someone puts down, the less likely you're going to run into this issue. Although, as you see, sometimes it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But if you did collect all that money, I mean, you're well protected in terms of really anything that can go wrong.
Yeah. And that guy's losing $40,000.
Yep.
I mean, that's huge.
Yep.
So in that scenario, what else could you have done to protect yourself further, if anything?
Because
it's really hard to say.
So one of the things that, and we'll talk more about this, but we want to do some research on the buyer. So prior to putting them in, and this is the decision all investors have to make when they're doing, you know, selling a property on contract for deed, all inclusive, trust deed and note, or doing a lease option, is what's your intent? Is your intent that you really want them to get a new loan within a certain time frame, or do you care?
Right.
And if you don't care, then just get as much money as you can to protect you
up front.
And you know, you'll be able to potentially work something out, or you'll keep them in there long term and whatever. So you're protected that way. If you're really looking at getting someone qualified for a new loan within a 2-year, 3-year, 4-year, 5-year period of time, the one lesson that I know is that if you leave it up to them, not a good idea. If you leave it up to the buyer to fix whatever issues or challenges they may have, it's probably 50-50 at best.
Right.
However, if they have a larger chunk of money, maybe now it's more like 75-25 that they can actually go and get this resolved. But if you want them to do it, you need to help them. And we'll talk about some different ways that you can help them.
You got to be proactive.
That's right.
Cool. Was there another example you
I've got a few different examples. So here's another one. This happened years and years ago. And this is what happens when you become a motivated seller. So I had taken over a property, probably subject to, and I'm now responsible for those monthly payments. And I wanted to lease option this property out. And back then, I didn't flood people to the house. I never understood how to get that many people interested all at once. So sometimes these houses would sit for a couple of months, which I didn't like because the monthly payments were coming out of my pocket. So I finally got someone interested in this house, and it was probably, it was probably like a $200,000 purchase price, something like that. And they offered me, I don't remember how I did this back then, but they offered me $6,000 as an option deposit. And I said, yeah, I'll take it. And I was motivated because I was making the monthly payments, didn't want to anymore. So I bypassed some of the stuff that I should have done because they said they had the money, they could pay it, they could afford the monthly payment, and they could come bring me that money now. So I skipped all the steps that you should be doing, which is, hey, we've got to run your credit. We need to see where your income's coming from. Can you actually afford this? So they said, yeah, we'll be right back. We'll bring you the $6,000. Well, I thought they would just go to the bank and get a cashier's check. Instead, they brought me $6,000 in $20 bills. Okay, that should have been a major red flag, right? But I was a motivated seller at that time. So, and by the way, that property ended with the U.S. Marshals raiding that house and me getting really lucky that they didn't take it away from me. So.
Wow. That's awesome. So that's a great example of why you should get a bigger down payment and do a little more research on your buyer.
Well, absolutely. But in the first scenario, I don't know that the seller is thrilled about this. Maybe he is. Maybe he feels like, hey, I'm going to make even more money from it. I don't really know. But he knew. He knew going in that, hey, I'm willing to trade off the big down payment
for the risk involved due to that guy's
credit.
And
if you're staying in it, and let's talk about what's a big down payment. So if you're going to get a house and you're going to sell it on owner financing, I would tell you that you are missing the boat if you are taking anything less than 10% down. And in some cases, you're going to get more. Some cases, you might be able to get 13, 15, even 20 or 25% down. That would probably be more the exception than the rule. But my rule would be 10%+ down.
Right.
If you take less than that, you're probably looking at either there's not enough interest in this property, or
you haven't found the right buyer.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
That's a great example. Okay, number two.
Okay, number two. So when you're dealing with your seller, with your buyer, is explaining how you're going to set this up. So let's be clear with the buyer. Now, when I say that, if you've taken this property subject to, and you are now passing that on, which I would not recommend in the least. We've talked about this numerous times that I don't want to pass on a subject to deal to someone else.
Yeah, but without having recourse for the seller.
But let's be clear, what no matter what it is, contract for deed, a wrap, everything, that we want to be clear on how it's going to work, what the potential risks are, and we want them to 100% understand it. Because if we're selling them the property and something goes wrong, well, you said this, you said that, or you didn't tell me that. If you're wholesaling it, you have the same issue, and now you're out of it, and they're still coming back to you. And yeah, so you want to be clear, and the way that I think you should be clear is two ways. One, prior to signing the purchase agreement, that you're going through the details and explaining how this will work, and here's the benefits, here are the drawbacks. And then second, in the purchase agreement, so that any misunderstanding, that's the document you go back to, that and the docs that are prepared at closing that they sign. So
right.
We want all those docs to be clear about, hey, you're doing a wrap. There's an underlying mortgage. That mortgage has a due on sale clause. The lender could potentially call that loan due.
Yeah.
Whatever it may be, you want to be clear on what it is, how it works. Now, where I think some investors get a little confused is that they try to give all that information up front before they ever have a deal, before they ever have the interest. So that would be like me coming to you, Jonathan, and say, yeah, you know, I'm interested in buying your house. You mentioned you'd be okay taking payments for your equity, and now I'm talking about a seller, by the way, so I don't want to get too confusing here going back and forth. But if I then told you, there's a due on sale clause, and you know, could get loan could be called due, or I'm going to take it subject to, you're going to have no recourse.
Yeah.
I mean, you're done.
Yeah.
And you're going to have the same issue with the buyer.
Yeah. We talked about that a little bit on the last couple episodes as well.
Yeah.
So you need to put a deal together first and then be clear on the expectations.
That's right. So the same thing would go with the buyer. So when you find that buyer, you're advertising a property with terms. And one of the things that I would tell you that goes along with what we just said about the down payment is you don't want to advertise the down payment.
Right.
Because that is going to limit you on how much money you potentially could get. So you're trying to get the most amount that you can. But now, hey, here are the terms. Great. They've agreed to that. All right. Well, now let's talk about how this is all going to work. It's done as contract for deed, which means that you're not going to be on title.
Uh-huh.
However, your interest is going to be protected in this way. Or it's an all-inclusive, and we're wrapping a mortgage. You are going to be on title. If you default, this is what's going to happen, that there's a due on sale clause, that.
Yeah. You need to be aware of that.
Yeah, yeah. We want to be clear.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, number three, and this one is in conjunction with number two, and that is do not draft your own documents.
Okay? that should be a no-brainer. That should be common sense. But
it should,
but it's not, right?
And I can tell you that years ago, it was common to negotiate with the seller, negotiate something like subject to, so taking over existing debt, literally bringing the documents to your house, signing on the kitchen counter, and then bringing you to a notary to get it notarized, get the deed notarized, and you are done. You go record the deed yourself. People love that because they could skip the title
cost.
Search,
yeah.
They could get it done very quickly.
Yeah.
I would not recommend that any longer.
Absolutely not.
I'd want your purchase agreement to be, if you're not using the state-approved REPSI, that you'd want your attorney to look it over, give you the heads up, add any clauses that, you know, like what we talked with Dave, we talked with Jeff, we talked with Jax about different clauses that you may want to have in these types of deals. Mm-hmm. So that is not what you want to be doing.
No, absolutely not. And you should, and a lot of these documents you can just get from a title company.
If they have an attorney that works there, yes, very often they will. If they don't, they're going to want an attorney to write them up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we would always advise to go to an attorney first.
Yeah. So don't be drafting these kinds of documents yourself. I don't care how much you think you know.
All right.
Okay. Here's a good one. This one, it seems so simple, but I swear it always comes back. So being clear to the buyer when the payments begin. So we do a lot in our LOI that the payments will begin 30 days after closing. So what happens if you close the middle of the month? So I typically like the payments to begin at the end of the month or the very beginning of the month. Just keeps things very consistent.
Yeah.
But why, you know, if it's coming the middle of the month, is that really good for the seller? So you want to be clear, because I'm telling you, when it's not clear, all kind of issues happen.
Absolutely.
So you might say in an LOI or, you know, up front, hey, our payments will start 30 days from time of closing. But as you're signing the purchase agreement, you may want to say payments are going to begin on this date rather than days after something. So
yeah,
be clear when the buyer is now responsible for making a payment.
Very good.
The other thing that you should know is that most often the buyer's payment does not begin right away. It's typically interest accrues in the arrears. So they're making a payment typically 30 days after they close. Now, you're writing up this agreement. You make the rules. So, you know, if it's 2 weeks, 3 weeks, then it's so be it. If it's 5 weeks, 6 weeks, then just be clear so everyone knows when the buyer is going to start making the payment.
Okay. And when you close in the middle of the month, Jeff, when you have a closing in the middle of the month, do you prorate the rest of that month and have that in escrow?
If there's a tenant, you mean?
Yeah.
So during the closing, there's certain things that would be prorated. So if there's any rents, the rents would be prorated.
Mm-hmm.
If there's deposits, the deposits would be credited to the buyer. So
yeah,
less money that they would have to bring in. And then really the last thing would be tax. And so if you're doing, let's say, and we're getting a little off topic, but that's a great question. So if you're doing a wrap, so there's an underlying mortgage, mm-hmm, and the taxes are escrowed in that payment, which most of the time they are.
Yeah.
There's no reason to do a tax proration because those taxes are going to get paid when they need to get paid.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to do that. So you can actually take off the tax prorations on, you know, the seller closing costs. If there is no loan, then you probably do want to have the tax prorations because, hey, if I'm buying a house right now in October and my taxes are due in November and I don't get any tax proration from the seller, that means I get to pay for the whole year, even though I've only owned the property for 6 weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So, good question.
Okay, I won't get too far off that rabbit or down that rabbit trail.
Okay, so this one we talked a little bit about with Dave Kenny, and this is that being clear to your buyer that the payment, even though here's the payment that you're starting with, this may not be the payment that continues long term. So really the thing that changes are the taxes.
Yeah.
So if the taxes go up by $150 a year, that means your payment's gone up and
well,
you're the one that's responsible for it.
Right.
So hopefully, whether it's the third party escrow service that you set up, or if the buyer is making payments directly to the bank, or directly to the seller, hopefully without any underlying loans, that whoever is getting that information is passing that information on.
Yeah, and do you specify that in closing docs, that the payment is subject to change with taxes?
It would be an excellent thing to have in those closing docs.
Yeah, having the buyer agree to make the payments additional payment or increase in payment if it did increase by taxes.
I can't remember which attorney that we were talking to, but there was a story. One of them was telling me about how they did closing docs and that they did not really specify who would be responsible for the taxes, which is, I mean, that should never happen. And the buyer was thrilled, and then the taxes went up considerably, and there was an issue that there was an argument, between the two of them.
Between who should cover that increase.
Right. Neither were very happy. So one of the things that I always try to look at is, what are all the things that could go wrong?
Yeah.
And try to account for them. How can I be as simplistic as possible, but still include, what are the most common things that could go wrong here, and let's account for them.
So, yeah. Yep.
Making sure, one, buyer knows they're responsible for those taxes, and two, that they're responsible for whatever they may become. So taxes can go down, too.
Yeah.
So they're responsible. It is a separate payment on top of their principal and interest payment.
Right, right. Very good.
We've talked about this a number of times, but we'd be foolish not to have it on the list, and that is making sure the buyer gets a separate insurance policy on their property. And so if there is no loan on the property, they're certainly going to get an insurance policy as the homeowner, as either an owner-occupant if they're living in it, or as a landlord if they are doing something else with it. They're going to name the seller as mortgagee. That would make them the bank. So, hey, if the property burned down, the bank gets their proceeds, the owner gets their proceeds.
Yeah.
If there is already a loan on it, well, the seller already has insurance, most likely escrowed into the monthly payment. Naming the bank that made the underlying loan the mortgagee.
Yeah.
We don't want to touch that. We want to leave that alone.
Yeah.
At the very most that you want to do is have the seller call and say, all right, I was living in the house. Now I'm not. I'm going to convert it to a landlord policy rather than an owner-occupant policy. And they're done.
Okay? Right.
They just leave that in place. You now go get a new insurance policy, either as an owner-occupant if you're going to occupy the property.
Yeah, or as a landlord.
Right.
Yeah, an additional insurance policy.
That's right. Now, and to me, I know it's an additional expense, and but it's worth it.
Yeah, it's a necessity, really, because the risk is just too great.
Yeah, then no reason to, you just created a deal with terms. Hopefully it's a good deal for you. I mean, insurance is, hopefully you never use it to begin with, but this is how you got to cover yourself.
Yeah, and anytime anyone buys a house, there's always an insurance policy that has to be purchased anyway. So just look at it that way. Even though there might be one in place still, just think of it. That's kind of how I've looked at it. Like there's always an insurance policy that has to be purchased.
Yep.
So that's it, and it's additional insurance.
Yep.
Okay, so that was number six, right?
Yes.
So number seven.
So
that mistake number seven investors make with buyers.
Going over the due on sale clause, or not going over the due on sale clause when dealing with the buyer. So if there's an underlying loan.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to go over a couple of different things regarding the due on sale. So first, I want to tell them if there's an underlying loan, that there's a due on sale clause in that loan. And if if the lender were to find out that potentially they could call the loan due, and you know, we can go through all the stuff about they don't want non-performing assets, they want performing assets. They're in the business of collecting payments, not foreclosing on properties that are being paid on.
Right.
So
right.
We can go through all that. But we want to be clear, there is that, and there is some risk.
Yeah.
Second kind of thing is we want to be clear, there's a due on sale clause for you as well as the buyer. So you may not be able to go then sell it again on another
wrap. Very good point, yeah.
To someone else, because if you're the seller, you want to maintain control.
Yes.
So, and then you would have to unravel all this if it were to go bad.
Right.
It's not that big of a deal, but I would want to have the right, at least, to determine if I'm going to allow that. And that right is the due on sale clause.
Yeah.
So, if I'm the seller, I'm putting that in. If I'm wholesaling it, I'm not giving that buyer the right to go sell it again on a contract. And we actually just had one where they do have a due on sale and they did just go sell it again. So we could call the whole loan due and force their hand, or we can just leave it and let it go. So
what are you going to do?
I don't know. It's a property that we wholesaled, and at this point I would just say as long as payments are being made that it's all right.
Yeah.
It's not what I want. It's not what we agreed to. But as long as the seller is getting her payments, it's probably all right. If there's any issue, I think we'll probably try to unravel the whole thing.
Is it a short-term scenario?
It's like a three-year scenario, okay. I think.
Yeah. So longer term, it could create more issues. Shorter term, it's less likely.
It can create issues either way.
Yeah.
But
it's just less likely if it's a shorter term.
Well, okay. And if you think about it, think about this. So the seller agreed to terms with us that they knew that we were going to assign to someone else.
Right.
So we found the buyer. Okay. Now the deal is between the seller and the buyer. Okay. They're now responsible for those payments.
Right.
Okay. They now transferred it to yet a new buyer. So who's still responsible to the seller?
So they transferred. So the original buyer is.
The original buyer is still responsible
to the seller.
But so if the first buyer, so no matter what, that first buyer has to protect this property, right? Because if their buyer stops paying, most likely
they're still responsible.
Right?
They're still on the hook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in reality, there's two people on the hook now for the seller in terms of making sure she gets payments.
Payments are made. Uh-huh.
So it's really not terrible, but yeah. I don't really know what they've set up and how they tried to set it up. Yeah. And
I guess I haven't really thought about it that way. But, you know, you don't want it to continue that way, like, because you don't want that second buyer to be able to do the same thing.
Correct.
and continue to sell
that
it.
Second buyer, what kind of option they may have gave that even second buyer. So maybe they don't even have a due on sale clause, which is really not allowed. I mean, if the first one has a due on sale clause, then you know, they've already violated it. And if they then allow them to not have a due on sale clause, well,
and they do the same thing.
it all originated in one place. And if you don't follow the rules from then on, it can all come crumbling down really quickly.
Yeah, yeah. So let me ask you this. If you're the seller, Jeff, you own a property, you want to do you want to sell it on seller finance, and you find a buyer, and that buyer they close on the property, and then they go and sell the property on seller financing. What would you do? Would you call it due, or
it depends? Well, first of all, if the buyer came to me first, I would be much more inclined to at least listen and hear them out.
Yeah, so if they were open about it.
Yeah, because then we could structure it together So I'm still protected, and that they're still protected.
Okay, let's say they didn't come to you first.
Which is pretty much more often the case than not. Well, first of all, I have to find out. So it may not be that simple to find out unless I go looking for it. So yeah, maybe all of a sudden I start getting payments from someone else. That might be a red flag. But if it's going through third-party escrow, I'm not sure how I'm seeing that that happened.
You would have to check to see if there was anything filed on title.
Well, and if it's contract for deed, who knows how they've then set it up.
Yeah.
There may be another notice of interest or something filed. So, one, it may be difficult for me to find out. If I did find out, I probably wouldn't be too happy about it. And I would go back to my buyer and I'd demand to see what they've done.
Yeah.
I'd probably also point out that what they've done is not allowed. And now I'd want to know how they're going to truly protect me in this whole thing. Or I'm not looking at trying to take properties away from people.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to hurt people. I'm not trying to end up in lawsuits. I'm not trying to do all that. But ultimately, we got to protect one person, and that person should be you, right?
The seller.
Well, and if you are the seller, it should be you.
Yeah.
In this case, you should be a little selfish and protect you first and foremost.
Right.
And if it were me and we'd assigned that contract, yes, I would side, in this case, with the seller because buyer did something they weren't supposed to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would look at it and I would decide what I think.
Yeah, so you'd have a conversation and you would ask to see what they set up and then just kind of go from there. That's probably the best.
And if you're not comfortable looking and understanding what's been set up, then it's time to include an attorney in the mix.
Absolutely.
And get their advice on what,
if you don't understand the documents that they drafted and had their buyer sign, you absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's wrap it up right there. That was number 7, correct?
Correct. So we'll do another 7 or 8.
Okay, we'll continue that on the next episode. These are great points to keep in mind. I love these.
Some are pretty. I mean, we've talked numerous times about some of them, but I want you to be comfortable in going out and doing this, and just like in every aspect of real estate, it's not really terribly hard, but there are a lot of details and you've got to be aware of the details.
Yes.
Now, are you always going to be aware? That what I would suggest is you create a checklist and you check them off as you do each deal. Yeah. So you make sure you dealt with each one.
Yeah. Very good. Very good advice. Okay, guys. Thanks so much for listening. If you guys want to reach us, we have a hotline that we've been trying to pitch. So if you guys have questions or you have a deal scenario you want to run by us, I'll present that to Jeff and we'll
topic pick his ideas.
Yeah, topic ideas. We need topic ideas for sure. But anyway, the Creative Financing Hotline is 877-409-8090. Again, 877-409-8090. 8090. You can also reach us at www.thecreativefinancingpodcast.com. So, any last words?
Let's do this.
Until next time, guys, create some terms.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Financing Podcast. We need your feedback to continue to bring you the best strategies in creative financing. So please subscribe, rate, and review this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We greatly appreciate your ear, and please pass this on. Until next time, create some terms. This show offers general information on creative financing strategies and real estate investments. Nothing contained herein should be considered personal, legal, or financial advice. Every state has individual laws governing the use and type of documents used to execute strategies discussed herein. You should consult with a local licensed real estate broker and attorney before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed, and opinions of the guests are their own. Profits are not guaranteed, and there's always inherent risk in real estate investing.